Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Lead customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us live on Building Fortunes Radio. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. I playfully say, if you're unfamiliar with my voice, my name is Peter Mingles. We run this whole thing. We started Building Fortunes Radio, I think it was December of 2012. So right around there, I think we might have run our first radio show in January of 2013. So we've been doing this for quite a while. And as a result of lots of things, we have hosted a bazillion radio shows. That's just a slight exaggeration. But one of the radio shows we did in August of 2015 was talking with an MLM critic. His name is Roger Van Vlissingen. And Roger and I were talking about stuff. And by coincidence, FTC had just temporarily shut down a network marketing company called Vima, and we had a really lively conversation about that action because the FTC was relatively kind of slow or dormant during those periods of time. And they kind of became alive when Herbalife came around and then Vima. And we had a nice conversation. Then shortly after that, I got a phone call from Scott Johnson, who I didn't know at the time. And he said, you know, there's something that a lot of people are missing, and that's the tool scam associated with network marketing companies. And I kind of thought I figured out what he was probably going to be talking about relative to the tool scam, because I had hired and fired myself several times with Amway. And the biggest reason why I left Amway was because of what I would also call a tool scam, meaning I could see that more people were making more money on a local basis on the books, the audio cassettes, and the functions than they probably were on the products and the pitch they were pitching to everybody in the audience. Is you could become financially free, you know, that rags to riches story, if you just do what we do. And I'd say, that's false. You guys are frauds. That's not true. The little old lady sitting next to me is never going to be able to get a book or tape or a function. So you telling her that she can get rich and famous just like you is wrong. So it took me three times to conclude that that was the case, at least with the people that I had associated with Amway. So I said, this is it. I understand the tool scam. So when Scott finished his conversation with me and then mentioned his website, which, by the way, is still stoptheamwaytoolscam.wordpress.com, I said, I knew it. So we were talking a little bit, and we decided that we were going to do some radio shows on this stuff because I knew it, but only probably because of my previous business background and maybe my intuition on, wait a minute, something's not adding up here. And I realize a lot of really good people that are maybe less business savvy would probably not pick that up, and they would be abused by the tool scam associated with the MLM industry. So we started our radio show, unbeknownst to me. I didn't realize Scott really studied the MLM industry as much as he did. So when we started our conversations, we kind of expanded it, and we were given several gifts. Vima was one gift, and then Herbalife was another, and then we had the opportunity of exploring different websites to kind of bring up different things. So we've had every single Saturday plenty of material to bring to you if you want to listen in, so you could see some of the things that probably your upline is not going to talk about. Definitely your company's not going to get involved in as far as the explanations. Certainly you're never going to hear about any of this stuff if you go to the typical rah-rah shish-goomba stuff like that you'll see at the ANMP or some of the other meetings that have a tendency of going out promoting the industry, because they don't want you to know about this stuff, because then you might not buy or join, you know, or maybe you'd actually, you know, slow down your recruiting efforts. And I just said, you know what, that's crazy. We're going to show people where the potholes and the pitfalls are, and at least this way they can survive if they wanted to or not. But at least if you listen to enough of these radio shows, you're going to be able to figure out, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly in the home-based business arena relative to network marketing, and a few other things too, because sometimes we go off on some tangents. But having said that, I just want to introduce our guest. His name is Scott Johnson. So, Scott Johnson, thanks for being here.
Peter, thanks for having me again. I think you pretty much said everything I was going to say. So, have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time.
There we go. There we go. That's it.
Well, you know, it took you three tries, and I think probably what you were doing partially was trying to figure out, well, that group wasn't doing it right, so, you know, let me try a different group. Maybe they're doing it right, and maybe that second group wasn't doing it right, so let me try a third group. And what you found was you were 3 for 3 or 0 for 3, however you want to look at it.
Well, actually,
it only took me about a dozen years. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. Actually, I found out after the first try, and the second guy lied. And he said, no, that's not the way it is. So I said, okay, I'll give you another shot. But I'll probably figure out the same conclusion. And the third guy certainly lied. So I figured it out. I gave him the benefit of the doubt. But I was hoping that maybe I might have been wrong. But I was right the first time and just confirmed it 2 more times. So back to you.
Yeah, I mean, once you see it once and you know what the tool prices are, then you know, on the second group or the third group, whether or not they're making a lot of profit from the tools. Because if the prices are similar, then their profit is probably similar as well. Now, it took you 3 tries. It only took me a dozen years to figure it out. And actually, I didn't figure it out. My Upline Diamond got canned. He started his own website, his, you know, blog, which isn't up anymore. But somebody on that website asked him one time after he had put out sort of just some information that, yeah, I was making about $350,000 a year on average over the past 5 years. And diamonds typically, and there's not really an average diamond because some of them are much bigger than others. You know, some of them have diamonds in their downline. So, you know, a diamond is not equal to another one as far as profit, but the guideline, it's about $125,000 to $150,000 a year. Well, he said, I made $350,000 a year average over, you know, 5 years. And so somebody asked him, well, how much of that was Amway and how much was tools? And I really perked up at that question. And he didn't really answer. He came back with a non-answer answer. And that's where I started my anti-Amway blogging career, I guess you could say. Actually, my blogging career, I'd never really even blogged before. This was 2005. And, you know, he came back and said, well, you know, one diamond's profit is another diamond's, you know, federal tax bill. And like, you know, that's totally non-associated with the question. So I came on and I said, Bruce, his name was Bruce Anderson. I said, Bruce, you're not in Amway anymore. You don't have to lie. You can just give a straight up answer. So eventually he did answer that about, you know, 2/3 or more of that was from the tools. And then after that time frame, I actually had a telephone conversation with him. And at that time, I asked him, well, how long were you actually a diamond? Because, you know, when you go diamond, if you don't hold the organization together, you get to keep wearing the pin, but you're not making the money. And he said, well, I only had my diamond organization for like a year or two. And that would have been back in the early 90s. And then from there on, you know, I was lucky to qualify as emerald, which is, if you want to think about it as half a diamond, that's kind of what an emerald is. So he wasn't even making, you know, the money of an average diamond. He was only making an emerald money, except that his tool profit was far in excess of what his Amway profit was, and therefore he could have the lifestyle that he had. You know, he could live on the St. John's River in Florida. He could have a big ocean-going, you know, cigarette race boat. He could have a 1932 baby blue souped-up Pontiac. You know, motorcycles, airplanes, you know, all kinds of stuff like that, which just leads people to believe that there's a lot of money in Amway, and there really is not to that level. The money is really from the tools, and that's where, you know, multiple times, and I have on my website people that say, hey, when I was in Amway, I was making 10 times more from tools than I was from Amway. Or another guy said, my Emeralds and Above made 4 to 5 times more from tools than they made from Amway. And you always get those from former Amway people, not the current ones, because the current ones lie through their teeth because they don't want people to know that, obviously. So now, not all MLMs have tool scams, so I'm not here to trash the entire industry. But I haven't found very many MLMs that have very many retail sales. And that's really the definition of what the FTC uses as what is an illegal pyramid. If you don't have enough, and there's not a law that defines enough, unfortunately, I think there should be, but what the FTC has generally done is they've drawn the line at 50%. You know, if you have at least 50% of your volume going to outside customers, not your downline distributors, but real customers, then you're a legitimate MLM. You have free market demand for the products and or services, and you're a legitimate MLM. You can buy your own products and make profit off of them as long as you have that outside retail sale component as well. So those are what I see as the two major problems with MLMs. And I think both of us agree, at least I believe it's really kind of a brilliant concept. It's just not being executed properly by, as far as I can tell, any MLMs, except for Nexium that we've talked about. And I'll talk about Nexium. I'll let you make any other comments from there, and then we can dig into Nexium and other news of the past week.
Nope, we're good to go. All right, so let's kick it off.
So we've talked about Nexium. We've had a couple people on here, I guess at least one person that was involved in Nexium directly, Frank Parlato. Now, Frank runs a website called frankreport.com, and it's the most prolific, to me, it's the most interesting website on Nexium because the guy is just amazing at getting stories. And he just has sources and, you know, a lot of people out there trusting him and things of that nature. And his website, frankreport.com, this past week had a story because we've talked about in the past there were six defendants. The Department of Justice is going after six people criminally. The leader of the whole group, his name is Keith Raniere. Keith Raniere has been in jail since last March, you know, March of 2018, over a year ago. The second person is a person by the name of Claire Bronfman. She at least used to be a multi-hundred, you know, millionaire in the hundreds of millions. She squandered a lot of that with Raniere and just the legal bills over the past year. There was a person by the name of Nancy Salzman, who was kind of the co-creator of Nexium along with Raniere. And then her daughter was also tied up in it. Now, Nancy and her daughter, Lauren, had previously both pled guilty to RICO charges and RICO, was it RICO? And then there's RICO, I can't think of the right term, but it's the term for cooperating with others.
Conspiracy.
I can't think of the conspiracies. Yes, RICO conspiracy. So it's RICO and RICO conspiracy. So they pled guilty. I think Nancy actually pled only to one charge and a couple of, you know, predicate acts, as they call it, things that they did that show that RICO occurred. And then her daughter pled guilty to two charges. Now there's a sixth woman involved by the name of, what's her name? Karen something or other. I can't remember her last name. But anyway, she has not pled guilty yet. She's trying to get the charges dismissed because she claims that when she gave testimony to a grand jury, the Department of Justice didn't tell her that she was a target, and therefore, you know, she answered questions that she said she wouldn't have if she had known that. So the judge has to make a decision on that. I think if she loses that appeal, if you will, she's probably going to plead also, just like the other two also did. Now there's a sixth woman involved by the name of Allison Mack, and I never watched the show, but apparently there was a show called Smallville, which was Superman as a teenager, I believe, is the idea, and Allison Mack was Superman's sort of girlfriend, non-girlfriend. I guess she had the hots for him, and he didn't recognize it or something like that, and that was sort of the, you know, the big story of the show. Allison Mack also pleaded guilty to two charges of, again, the RICO and RICO conspiracy, as well as a couple other predicate charges, like I think she pled guilty to keeping somebody detained for about 2 years and something else. I can't remember the other thing. But anyway,
there's
so many weird.
She had a hostage. She had her own
yeah,
hostage.
Kidnapping, basically. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy stuff. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You know, if you said this is all going to be on a TV show, I think Hollywood would go, no, that's too far out there. You know, it's just not believable. But this is real. This is real stuff going on. So she pled guilty, and she was kind of in charge of this operation called DOS, which was this mainly female organization, and people call it branding, but what it really was these people were cauterized. You know, they make these, it's like a soldering gun, you know, except it's a medical instrument, and they would burn Ranieri's initials into right to the side of the pubic area, which if you look at, you know, like medical journals or even online, it's got one of the most prolific areas with nerve endings in the entire body. And they didn't use any painkiller. So this was to show loyalty to the group. This is what the whole idea was. But what really came out of it was, I think this was the other thing that Allison Mack pled guilty to, was they called it collateral. And the collateral was things like you would give nude pictures, or you would give a statement to say, if I have any of your children, I'm going to, you know, let you have them. And if I ever sell my house, you know, you get all the money. It was things like that that would keep people from, you know, from quitting and from, you know, being a problem. Well, obviously it got out of control and didn't go anywhere. But Mac was the main instigators of this DOS organization, and apparently she agreed that there really was collateral and people really were being threatened with making this information public if they ever left, or if they ever spoke up about it after they left. And so it was intended to produce loyalty, but it backfired, obviously. So anyway, the trial is supposed to start, I think it's May 7th. It was supposed to start late this month, but the DOJ asked for a two-week extension because there's a bunch of evidence that the judge has not decided yet whether it's going to be admissible. And he has to make that decision so that the DOJ can make their adjustments on how they're going to prosecute the case. So they asked for 2 weeks. They gave him 1 week. So May 7th is the trial start date. They're picking the jury right now. That's where they're at. I wouldn't be surprised if one, two, or even all three of them pled before the trial started. And of course they can plead during the trial too. But I wouldn't be surprised if all three of the remainders didn't plead guilty, because there's going to be some really nasty stuff coming out at trial if that's where it goes, you know, whereas they can keep some of this a little bit more confidential, but it's hard to predict these things. But that's where NXIVM is. NXIVM is funny enough, one of the only MLMs I've come across that it appears, I don't have the numbers for this, but it appears they had a lot of retail sales. They had a lot of people coming in for these courses. They gave courses on, you know, kind of self-improvement type stuff. And while all this weird stuff was going on in the background with the higher ups, the vast majority of people just came in, took a course or two, and left. And you know, that's kind of the definition of a legitimate MLM from a business perspective. Now, from a criminality perspective and all of their other actions that were going on, you know, it's not. But anyway, that's kind of a NXIVM update. I'll let you make any other comments, and then we can move on from there.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this one, because there were some, I mean, really powerful people as far as finances and levels of sophistication going on, like the money gals, like you said, the heirs of Seagram's fortune. And watching the people plead guilty and then seeing, like, it was almost like Allison Mack was the second in command. There were a lot of second in commands in different areas. But with Alice and Mac pleading guilty, that really has to hurt Keith Raniere as far as his mental state, because his whole world is crumbling behind him. These are people that were literally his sex slaves. He had her grooming other women so they would be there. His sex, this is the weird part, his sex slaves. So as weird and twisted as this gets, is as weird as twisted as this gets. But it all started with the feeder program of ESP, the Executive Success Program, which was the legitimate part, if you will, of their business. So there are thousands and thousands of people that went through the ESP program, and then they pick and choose maybe the vulnerable or the rich ones, and certainly the gals, to go into this sex slave thing. So it's weird, twisted, and very interesting. Then the Frank Report on frankreport.com, if you really want to jump into it, really exposes a lot of the just amazingly complex, convoluted issues on this one specific case, including like things like Michael Avenatti was hired, and now there's Mike Gregarios and other people as well. So it's very fascinating. It's better than, put it this way, you don't need a sitcom. Forget about Game of Thrones or whatever that might be. You know, you don't have to worry about watching Seinfeld. You can just follow this Nexium case and then get all your enjoyment as far as the curiosity from there. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, and the reason that this really came up in our show was about a year ago. I just came across this story. I think I was just on Twitter, and I just came across it and just, you know, by chance. And I looked into it a little bit, and I just thought to myself, man, this looks really strange from the standpoint that it looks very much like Amway, you know, and we didn't know nearly as much as we know now about what they were actually doing. But I just got this feeling, having experienced Amway for over a decade and studied it for even more than over a decade, you know, after leaving, that it just looked weird. And I just looked into this Raniere guy, and it turns out he actually got started in Amway. So he learned his fundamentals, if you will, and then applied them to, he had another company too called Consumers Byline. That was shut down by the governments. There was several states that were going after him. He finally shut it down, agreed to pay $40,000 without admitting guilt, you know, the usual stuff. But he took those same MLM principles from Amway to Consumers Byline. I understand he was in another Legal Shield type MLM for a short period of time before he started the ESP, which was then renamed Nexium, I think 2 or 3 years later. But I think it's still known largely as ESP in Mexico. And there's a lot of Mexican ties with Nexium. There's a lot of very, very wealthy people and extremely influential people behind Nexium in Mexico, including this character named Salinas, who's a former Mexican president and either the richest or the second richest guy in the country, and not from doing nice things. So this is, you know, way worse than just even what we've talked about. And there's at least rumors, and pretty strong rumors, that Nexium is still going full throttle in Mexico. So there's just a lot of crazy stuff going on. In fact, one of the crazy things this past day or so on frankreport.com is apparently, and this has been known for a while, but apparently it's been refreshed, that Raniere wants some of his witnesses to testify via video from Mexico because he's afraid of bringing him into the United States, he might get arrested. And it's kind of strange because, you know, if you have that much concern, then how good of a witness are they going to be anyway? You know, if they're also guilty, why do you want them as your witness? So it's just kind of a crazy deal all the way around.
It is nuts.
Anything more on that?
Nope, that's perfect.
Okay, let's move on to probably our most prolific website from a MLM standpoint, news and so forth, is BehindMLM.com. These guys do a great job of finding stories and updating stories too. They don't just throw it out there and then you forget about it. They keep track of them. And one of the stories that they've kept track of is Telex Free, and one of the last remaining characters from that, there's been one guy, I think he was the CEO or owner. He's serving a 6-year prison term, I think it is. Maybe he's a couple years into that. And then there's another sort of co-owner that fled to Brazil, and he's in Brazil, and we can't get to him because there's not an extradition treaty with Brazil. And there's a few other people that have been, I don't know if there has been anyone else put in jail, but there's been a lot of people giving up a lot of money that they got from Telex Free. But one of the last remaining people is a lady by the name of Faith Sloan, who we've talked about a number of times on this show. And the story is dated April 12, 2019, and the headline is Faith Sloan settles SEC's $1.2 million Telex Free fraud case. And I think we talked about her a week or two ago, that the SEC had dropped some of their charges, and this remaining one was still in effect, and it appears that was sort of the beginning of an agreement for a settlement. She agreed to pay the $1.2 million. I don't know where she's getting it from, because previously, she claimed she was broke, she couldn't pay her lawyer. I mean, it was all kinds of stuff like that. And now all of a sudden there's a $1.2 million settlement. now, interestingly, she's currently involved in at least two other MLM, and I believe they're both scams. And as far as I know, there's nothing in the settlement which prohibits her from participating in those. So if that's where she's coming up with her $1.2 million, it's just kind of a head-scratcher that the SEC doesn't have their hands around this better as far as making sure she doesn't continue to scam others. You know, Telex Free was a scam, but, you know, why are you not shutting her down from the ability to do similar things like Telex Free? That's, you know, what makes me just kind of shake my head and scratch my head, whatever, trying to figure out what's going on. Now, we haven't seen the whole settlement, so we don't know. There could be something in there that, you know, prohibits her from being involved in MLMs, because certainly that's happened in the past where people are, you know, prohibited for 5 years or 10 years or whatever from being involved in MLMs, you know, whether it's as a distributor or an owner or a consultant, you know, from any point of view. So, like I say, we don't know what the details of the settlement are yet, but hopefully that's part of it, but we don't know that. So back to you.
Yeah, and the part that's confusing for me, and I'm going to sound naive when I say this, is I don't know how in the world they settle with somebody like her for $1.2 million when they know that previous to that, she was claiming that she was actually broke. When they froze her assets or stuff like that, with Traffic Monsoon, I think she was associated with them as well. If I'm not mistaken, I don't remember. Maybe it was just Telex Free. But the reality was,
I think you're right.
When she's completely broke and then, you know, claiming that she has no money to live on, how in the world? And it's not like they gave her the money back. So they say, well, I'll give you the money back so you can give it back to us eventually. Where she picks up the $1.2 million to be able to pay them, I think this is mostly just for smoke and mirrors. That's the wrong term, but mostly for window dressing as far as a settlement is concerned. And maybe it's just like future leverage against her. But it's pretty solid to say that she does not have $1.2 million that she's going to be able to pay these people back with, because we know that the new scams that she's gotten started with probably didn't earn her that much money. So I don't know where they come up with those numbers or those agreements with Scott, and I think it's mostly just window dressing for whatever purposes, and I'm not sure. So back to you.
Now, you could very well be right. It could just be a, you know, $1.2 million agreement that she doesn't have, and it could be against future earnings or something like that, which would make it almost double bad, because if she's going to make her future earnings from another MLM scam and then hand it over to the SEC, then why not, you know, why doesn't the SEC just directly join the other MLM scams to get the money?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Because she's just a go-between. She's, you know.
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me, but yeah, it's just a crazy world. And like I say, we don't know the whole details. You know, maybe she found the money somewhere mysteriously, you know, or maybe the SEC did and she goes, oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Right.
We don't know. But you could be exactly right. Maybe this is just window dressing.
I think if I have my numbers right, and I may be wrong, there was a situation with Zeke Rewards where when they finally came up with whatever kind of settlement they did with a few people in there, they were responsible for like $850 million. So they had to actually sign like an agreement that they were responsible for the $850 million in debt. And maybe that makes good headlines, but obviously there's no reasonable person that's going to be able to come back after something like that and then be able to pay back $858 million after taxes in anybody's immediate lifetime. I mean, it's crazy. So I think it's mostly just for window dressing. So I don't know, but it's interesting and maybe puts the brakes on Faith Sloan a little bit, but I'm not so sure. I wouldn't be surprised. Who knows? But anyway, so back to you.
Yeah, it's hard to be surprised anymore, isn't it? We've just seen so many weird things over the past 3.5 years we've been doing this show. And by the way, I just thought about this as you were talking about the timeline that you mentioned before when you started your radio series back in late 2012, early 2013. That was the same time frame that Bill Ackman got really involved with Herbalife and trying to take them down with his $1 billion short on their stock, which ultimately he lost, but I think he did bring a lot of attention to the whole MLM scam world, a lot more awareness, you know, of how these things really work and, you know, the problems associated. Now, he didn't really go after the tool scam that Herbalife has, but he did make a big deal about the lack of retail sales. And, you know, the FTC eventually fined Herbalife $200 million, which, you know, it's a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, when you're a, you know, $5 or so billion a year company, you can afford that, especially when you've had, you know, 3 or 4 years to save up some money on the side to pay for an eventual fine like that. But they also had to hire a, Herbalife had to hire a auditor for 7 years to look at their books and make sure that they're doing all the things that they agreed to do, you know, things like don't pay unless you have actual customer sales and, you know, adequate levels of customer sales and those kinds of things. So, you know, you can count it as a loss, but I really look at it as, you know, a good awareness raiser in the industry. And I would maintain that if the FTC went after almost any MLM using the same criteria that they did against Bima and Herbalife, which coincidentally were about the same time frame, they would find the same problems. And why they haven't is befuddling to me, because I think it's just, you know, like shooting fish in a barrel. That's how easy it would be to find, you know, more people that were, you know, not doing things right. So, that's why we keep doing the show, Peter. Let's see. Anything more on that? I'll move on.
No, but I just wanted to interject a couple of non-cohesive points here. What I mean by non-cohesive, there's these, like, I got to stick them in somewhere, so I wanted to put them here. I was reading through a comment, I think maybe even by a comment on one of the Behind MLM articles, or maybe it was even Business for Home. I got to give Ted Knight and credit for this one. Businessforhome.org had something about the top CEO, the top payments of executives of publicly traded companies. And it was on a website, I think it was called salary.com or something like that, which lists the compensation of publicly traded companies. Because if you're a publicly traded company, you have to reveal all these things because you're publicly traded so people can make decisions about buying the stock or not. And it's amazing the dollar amounts some of these top executives make. So, you know, Herbalife, I think it was like $6 million or $3 million, or Avon was like $9 million for the year as far as total compensation. A lot of it, obviously, in some of these situations due to stock bonuses or bonuses in general. But the general counsel for some of these things, the VP of this, there's a lot of money in these publicly traded network marketing companies. So these are not rinky-dink, Mickey Mouse kind of salaries. These are sophisticated people who have the ability and the resources to play those games so they could survive that FTC, you know, investigation, do whatever they have to do to maneuver around it and be able to pay that $200 million fine, still stay in business so they can secure their, you know, massive, if you will, by comparison, compensation plans. So for all those people that think that MLM are like these, you know, these just stupid little garage-based, you know, rinky-dink scams, some of them are pretty sophisticated with some real serious money coming through them. So back to you.
Yeah, these are multi-billion-dollar-a-year companies, so it only makes sense that you would have highly paid executives. You have to hire people that have that experience and talent, and you're not going to just, you know, hire somebody off the street to be a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar-a-year company. So, and we were talking right before the show too about, you know, some of these nonprofit companies, like some of the MLM tool companies claim to be nonprofit. Well, that really only means corporate profits. That doesn't mean that the people running them aren't making any money. Some of them make, you know, millions of dollars a year. But they're, again, even if it's a nonprofit, if it's a big operation, if it's doing billions of dollars a year, and I'll use an example. I think the Red Cross is an example. You know, they're a big organization. It takes a lot of talent to run that thing, to, you know, respond to emergencies, to coordinate things, to keep all the books straight. You know, there's a lot going on there that has to be done right, and you need talented people to run it. So the reason I say that is, even if it's a nonprofit, it doesn't mean that the people running it aren't making a lot of money. And I'm not saying they shouldn't make a lot of money either. That was some of the comments that was in that article that you were referring to. A lot of people were saying, oh, that's just too much money to pay an executive. You know, they're not worth it. Well, they are, because that's what the market bears. I mean, if they went to a non-MLM company with the same volume, they'd probably be paid about the same amount of money. And so it only makes sense that they're going to be paid a lot of money in an MLM that's big also. And we were also talking about, I think it was $9 million a year for the CEO of Avon. Well, you know, Avon hasn't been doing too good. And she, I think it's a she, is a new CEO. And, you know, she's really, really taken a career risk, because Avon's kind of on the ropes. And if she's not successful, then she doesn't have a job anymore. And then she's also got this reputation of, oh, yeah, you were in charge of Avon when it went under. You were the CEO of Avon when it went out of business. And that's not a real good career enhancer. So now she can probably afford a pretty nice retirement if she's making $9 million a year. I think you made a good point when we were talking before the show. But
yeah.
But still, I mean, if you're in that atmosphere, let's say, then, you know, that's something that you're really taking a career chance on by getting in with one of those companies. So back to you.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Some other things I just wanted to throw in, just so I'm going to just toss these in there, not necessarily relevant today, but they may be relevant a little bit later on. A couple of things happen in the world of cryptocurrency. Number one, PewDiePie. So PewDiePie, the guy with 94 million subscribers on YouTube, the biggest YouTube channel, YouTuber, period, on the planet, decided that he was going to start live streaming on a relatively new live stream called DLive. And DLive has a cryptocurrency base to it as well. So that is a game changer. PewDiePie, the biggest YouTuber, doing something with cryptocurrency. Don't be surprised if you hear that in your neck of the woods relative to this whole cryptocurrency revision, because he does add a lot of credibility to a lot of things that he does, because just his massive power. Then also what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of kids and people that act like kids that watch him that are now going to be exposed to cryptocurrency. So watch out. Your cryptocurrency scams might take a little blip because PewDiePie is going to give it a little bit more credibility. The other thing that I wanted to – and Scott, I'll stop. So if you want to throw anything in there, you can throw anything in there.
Yeah, just real quick, Peter. He was basically defunded by YouTube, right? Didn't YouTube say, we're not going to allow you to make the profit you used to make, and that's, you know, why he had to move?
Right. So a lot of the – yeah, he was the first guy that they started to demonetize some of the things, and he was the darling of the YouTube. He lost his YouTube channel and some Disney contracts and all that sort of stuff a long time ago when they first started deplatforming people. But he's still been making a comfortable income, but I think what he's finally realizing, he sees the writing on the wall. He still does significant amount of money, I'm sure, with YouTube, nowhere near where he was before. He hasn't been banned like Alex Jones. But he basically says, listen, you know, I could see the writing on the wall of what you're doing to all my friends. And he's starting to move over in different directions, you know, kind of playing. So that's a biggie. Like that, like PewDiePie is a biggie in the YouTube world. So I just wanted to kind of mention that because he went to something with cryptocurrencies. And I don't remember the name of the cryptocurrency, but it's something really obscure. Nobody's ever heard of it before for the most part. But just the idea that he went there is huge. It's just huge. Now, you might not know it's huge. It's kind of like a tsunami that hit on another ocean, just hadn't hit you yet. But it's a big thing. So one other thing that I just wanted to mention, too, was relative to Julian Assange. Now, you might say, what does Julian Assange have to do with MLM? Not a whole bunch, specifically. But let's take a look at, you know, what was he in trouble for. Julian Assange has, to the best of my knowledge, really never stepped on the United States land, but yet he's going to be facing, if everything goes by Britain letting him come back here, and there's probably no signs that that won't happen, he can be facing jail time for a little bit or a long time here in the United States, and he was never, ever, ever in the United States before. So for all those MLM people that think that you could do work in a foreign country and never be hurt in the United States, that's not true, and there's just one more example. So although there's not a specific correlation between WikiLeaks and all that sort of stuff, Julian Assange's example is one. And one last thing just relative to Julian Assange, a lot of people don't know this, but if it wasn't for Bitcoin, Julian Assange would have never had the money or the funding that he did to be able to continue with WikiLeaks. And I think the day that he was arrested through Bitcoin, WikiLeaks had raised over $32,000 just for that day in Bitcoin donations. So for those people who think Bitcoin is not around anymore, it's still alive and functioning and doing a lot of cool things relative to the world of the world. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story with Julian Assange, because I haven't really researched it real closely, but apparently he had not met some conditions from the British court, and I don't really have a full understanding of that. That was the reason he was arrested. I mean, he's been living there.
Yeah, he skipped bail. He was accused of basically having sex with a woman without a condom, knowing that he had STDs, and she got STDs. So she, in the countries they were in, she basically brought him up on charges. Well, he skipped charges because he knew if he left that Ecuadorian facility, he was going to, you know, be extradited into the United States and never come home. So he skipped bail. So basically he skipped bail, and that was in Britain. So Britain's getting him on some bogus charge of skipping bail. Oh, by the way, the charge was dropped, or he was found innocent. So he skipped bail on a charge that eventually was dropped. So you'd say, well, then that doesn't count, does it? But no, because you skip bail based on the technicality. And the reason why they're trying to pull him back into the United States has nothing to do with, like, disclosing all the information of all the bad things that the United States was doing. They're trying to bring him back to the United States because he helped Chelsea Manning, which was Bradley Manning, you know, the guy before he was a girl, who actually stole all this stuff. He gave him some encouragement and maybe some helpful hints on how to break in. So that's why they're bringing him back. So it's a bogus charge in both things. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. But the most interesting thing for me is the idea that, you know, the power of the United States government to pull you in if they really want to get you. So for all those people that pull these scams and then go to Taiwan or Singapore or Malaysia or wherever else they might go thinking that they are okay because they're so far away, that's not necessarily true. Now, you may not be like Julian Assange, but there are plenty of situations we never hear about every day where people get arrested and then brought back into the United States. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, and to your point, Peter, there's a lot of concern about First Amendment rights because just publishing that information is a First Amendment right. Now, stealing it is not, and that's what Bradley Manning did, was he stole it. Now, did he get help from Assange to steal it? I don't think he needed help because he was already, in the military and he had access to that equipment. He obviously would know how to download stuff. I can't imagine any knowledge that Assange would have that would have assisted him. Even if he said, "I'd like to have this information," that's not even a crime. Just because you want information, every media organization in the world wants information, but it's the guy that gets it. But it's not the media that disperses it that's a crime. That's pretty well settled law. If you're a media organization, and actually almost anybody can be a media organization now with the internet, right? You can act as the media. I mean, I look at my websites as that's the media. I may not be a licensed, whatever that means, journalist, but I can actually come up with real news, not fake news. I don't need to do the fake news thing. But what's interesting about the Assange arrest to me was, I think that case, they dropped the charges, like, I'm thinking like 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. It's been a long time, and he's just been sitting there in the Ecuadorian consulate for, 2 or 3 or 4 years. What took him so long to go after him? It just,
Well, what they did,
the
what
whole
he did was
timing
he
of it
started,
is.
yeah, what he did was he started pissing off Ecuador. So the leader at Ecuador, he started throwing his WikiLeaks stuff against. So that's really what did him in. So
Oh,
he
okay.
basically
So they turned
started
him over
complaining about,
essentially.
yeah, he basically
Okay.
said, you better stop, if you were smart, you'd shut up and you wouldn't like talk about me, the president of Ecuador is saying. And he kept releasing negative information about the president or whoever of Ecuador. So that's when he got pissed. It's like, listen,
That's
you're
pretty
stupid.
stupid.
Stones are stupid. Yeah, stones are stupid. I'm the guy that's been protecting you for a while. And it was a new president or something like that. Yeah, so yeah, common sense didn't go very far. Maybe his principles or whatever. Or who knows? Let's face it, Scott, if me and you were locked up in a room for a while, like 7 years, we'd probably go crazy too. So
Yeah, you're exactly
very
right.
interesting. Yeah,
Yeah.
and the Julian Assange situation is probably very interesting because I think he had visitors. Like Pam Anderson, like the Playboy bunny, the whatever, the beach babe. She visited him for more than just a visit, if you know what I mean. So I think he had his share of in women that wanted to do their favors. So it's a very interesting story. Yep. A very interesting
Yeah,
story.
I hadn't heard about Pam Anderson visiting. I knew that Sean Hannity visited him, like, I think it was a couple of years ago. He had an
Yeah.
interview with him and basically, got Assange to claim that, he didn't get the information from any Russians. That was the main thrust of the
Right.
interview. So, but yeah, those are both good, relevant stories to, not just world events, but how they tie into cryptocurrency, which we know is all over the place, both MLM and not MLM cryptocurrencies. In fact, if you go to bindmlm.com, we only cover a small percentage of the stories. There's a lot more there, and a lot of them are cryptocurrency MLM stories. So if you want to learn more about that, we covered one coin here, but there's a bunch of others that are constantly on BehindMLM.com as far as, controversial and so forth. It's definitely a main thrust of MLM these days. Let's see, Peter, what else do we have here? It was
I
kind
got
of
a
a
separate,
slow week. Go
yep, I
ahead.
got another separate one for you, but somewhat maybe might show up on the horizon. One of our favorite websites, truthinadvertising.org, and if you don't want to spell out truthinadvertising.org, you can go to tina.org, TINA.org. They are talking about trends in alkaline water. So basically, there's a whole bunch of class action lawsuits against companies that are claiming health benefits from alkaline water. So the theory goes that your body, if it's acidic, cancer can thrive. But if your body is basic, which is alkaline, cancer can't survive and disease can't survive in an alkaline environment. And one of the Nobel Prize people kind of proved that a long time ago. It's kind of like putting goldfish in salt water, can't do it. So if you can make your body alkaline, you can heal yourself and kill cancer. So that's how a lot of these things are sold. So there's a lot of companies, I won't name them, that either have alkaline water, like you buy the water or you buy the device that makes the water. And in Tina.org, if you look, there's something called CA Trends. If you look, it's right up on the head banner. But they're talking about several class action lawsuits against companies that are making medical claims or claiming that whatever they do with this alkaline water. So hasn't touched MLM yet because none of the companies that I see are listed here, but there's several companies that sell devices that are supposed to make this water alkaline, and maybe they might be the next ones in the class action lawsuits, just kind of predicting a trend. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, that's interesting, Peter, because, you know, if you wanted to make alkaline water, I guess you could put a drop or two of bleach in a gallon of water. You know, that'll make it alkaline.
Yeah, I don't know about bleach. I know baking soda. Baking soda would be like
whatever water. Makes it a little bit basic versus acidic. I mean, they treat water with chlorine anyway. I kind of figured that most tap water is probably slightly alkaline anyway, just because it's treated with chlorine. But I never really studied that as far as, you know, the pH of tap water. I just assumed it was slightly, and maybe these other waters are more basic, you know, to make them more powerful, so to speak.
Yeah, and there's something to do with, you know, your bloodstream is different from your water. Like, you drink water, it goes into your stomach, and then you're going to pee it or poop it, perhaps, or sweat it out. But it doesn't necessarily go into your bloodstream the same way. So there's always been some questions about whether drinking alkaline water is going to actually make you more alkaline. You're just going to, if you do a pee strip, if it's going to be more alkaline. But the reality is, there's a lot of people that are in these industries, and these machines can be rather expensive. Enagic is a company that sells those. There's a lot of other ones as well, and they could run into the hundreds, thousands, or more dollars for this alkaline water. So it's like it's one of these things that you want to take a look at. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, that's something to certainly keep track of. You know, Amway's had this product called Perfect Water for several years, and I don't know what the pH was claimed to be. It was supposed to be ultra pure, so I assumed it was pretty much neutral, you know, not acid or basic. But, you know, when you do drink a glass of water, it does get absorbed through your small intestine. You know, it goes into your bloodstream, or else you would dry out. So it seems like it makes sense that water, at least some of it, eventually shows up in your bloodstream just to, you know, keep everything from drying out. So I'm not a doctor or anything, but, you know, when you get dehydrated, you drink water, which, you know, rehydrates you, which means to me it goes into your bloodstream, at least some of it does. Now, another thing, when you think about the body, you know, a lot of our body is made up of muscles, which are protein, and the components of proteins are amino acids. So so I don't know, you know, what interplay there is between, you know, the amino acids, which I assume are slightly acidic, versus drinking an alkaline water. There's a lot there that I don't know because I'm not a medical type person. But it's interesting that all of that seems to be in the news now. Again, it seems to go in cycles.
Like I said, the lawsuits are against traditional companies that are making these claims. But let's face it, you know, this sets the precedent. And then all of a sudden some lawyer says, well, wait a minute, isn't there a network marketing company that makes these devices and makes these claims. And once there's a precedent or just a money-hungry lawyer or money-hungry class action suit, you never know what's going to happen. So we might see a trend on the horizon. So who knows?
Yeah, you might be predicting the future here. But whether you're an MLM company or not an MLM company, if you make a claim, like a medical claim, then you have to be able to back it up with a study, you know, at least one study. And it's got to be legitimate. It can't just be, you know, asking five people if they feel better. It's got to be a little bit more scientifically rigorous than that. So, yeah, we'll see. But that is an interesting idea to keep track of here as we move forward. There was another story on BehindMLM.com that I just wanted to mention because we had talked about this before, I believe. And it's an April 7th, 2019 story. And the headline is Dish granted $5.9 million judgment against TV Vision. And I won't even try to pronounce his name. It's P-S-H-E-H-A-L-O-U-K. That's a whole mouthful. Anyway, this company apparently was ripping off Dish with their programming and reselling it. And they got caught. And apparently they never showed up to court because this was just a default judgment almost $6 million. And I think we mentioned it before just because, you know, Dish is a pretty big and well-known company. And these guys were basically stealing their content, rebroadcasting it, you know, selling it in an MLM environment. And I don't think they're not even operating anymore. I can't imagine that they would be operating since they were sued. But anyway, that was just one of those other stories I wanted to mention in passing. Let's see, what else was there, Peter? There was a story that you'd sent me earlier in the week, Peter, about there was like four pretty good-sized MLMs, and they had come out with some information regarding the number of customers and the number of distributors and trying to make the argument that hey, we're legitimate and all of that. And I just thought there was a lot of tricky words and phrases in there where it just got my suspicions up that they weren't really telling the whole story. And I don't know this, but I just know their reputations as companies. And I know that a lot of the wording was just tricky words. You know what I mean? The way they phrased things, they were very careful to say things certain ways. But the bottom line to me, like we talk about every week, is, you know, no matter how many customers you claim you have or how many distributors you claim you have, what really counts is who's buying the products. You know, is it at least 50% of the products that are being bought by whatever the number of customers there are? And then, you know, is the amount that's being bought by the distributors either that much or less? That's what denotes a legitimate MLM. It's not the number of customers, because if those customers aren't buying nearly as much as the distributors, then you don't really have evidence of free market demand. You have evidence of what I call sympathy sales. You know, like my mom used to buy skincare products from Amway from me. It wasn't because, you know, and she did enjoy the products. She thought they were good products, but she wouldn't have done it except for me. She wanted to support her son. You know, her son was trying to run a business who at the time thought it was legitimate, and she was just trying to be a nice mom, like most moms are nice. So she bought skincare from me. Well, that counts as a retail sale, but that's what I call the sympathy sale, is she was just being mom. And and that's why, you know, the level is 50% or more is kind of what the FTC looks at, because, you know, it's pretty easy to imagine somebody's mom or dad or brother or sister or good friend or whatever, you know, buying a product here and there. But what really counts is there enough volume such that there's evidence of real sales going on, not just these sympathy sales. So I still have a hairy eyeball towards that information, but I'll let you make more comments.
No, I remember reading the things. I think it was Herbalife's description specifically, because it was publicly traded companies talking about distributor earnings, and I think they wrapped customers in there as well. But as I was reading it through, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like really very confusing. Like, what are they really saying here? So they were making it sound as if, you know, they got all these customers, but the way they phrased it was like, oh, I guess it's their own definitions all over again. So who knows? It was very interesting. And I think that article originated also on Ted Knighton's site, businessforhome.org. So if you want to go to businessforhome.org, you can find it on Ted Knighton's site. So every once in a while, Ted writes some pretty good stuff or has some posts some pretty good stuff. Having said those things, though, of course, when you go to businessforhome.org, watch out because there's a lot of goofy things there as well. So every once in a while, he gets it right, so I got to give him credit. Lots of times, he's still promoting, you know, remnants of OneCoin or OneCoin clones, which is where he gets it wrong. And that's not even my opinion. That's fact. He likes to say things like he only reports facts and figures that are real. So I'll just say there's facts and figures that Ted doesn't know what he's talking about relative to a lot of the things that he talks about relative to cryptocurrencies. So anyway, so back to you, Scott. And we're just about running out of time, so I don't know if there's any other stories, but I'll just kind of I'll leave it at that. I'm done.
Yeah, just to make one more comment on that Herbalife thing, you know, that was one of the things that the FTC really went after Herbalife for as far as their settlement, was they said, you know, you have too much of a hazy definition between what is a distributor and what's a customer, and you need to have a very defined line. A customer is someone who buys something for no other benefit other than trading the money for the product. There's no, you know, hope of future wealth by sponsoring people. That's the definition of a distributor. Now, I wouldn't put it past Herbalife or any other MLM to go out there and say, look, you need to be a customer first because we need customers. And then after a couple of months, you can become a distributor. I wouldn't put them past that they're trying to cut the books like that. But a lot of these customers that are in MLMs are really failed distributors, you know, that have been trying to sponsor people and have been unsuccessful. And when they're unsuccessful at sponsoring anybody, a lot of these MLMs define them as customers. But all they are really are failed distributors, you know, failed from the standpoint of they were unable to sponsor anybody. But the act of trying to sponsor somebody is what makes you a distributor. The ability contractually to sponsor somebody, whether you're successful at it or not, that's a distributor. You may not be good at it, but your purchases are distributor, internal consumption, not customer purchases. And that's where Herbalife and a lot of other MLMs really try to, you know, have this large gray area where they can manipulate the numbers and make it look however they want to look, advantageous to them, of course. So that'll be my cap for the night there, Peter. I'll let you say anything more on top of that, and we'll talk again next week.
Perfect, and I think we're done. So let's see. This week is, what is today? Today is Thursday, so we have what? Palm Sunday next. So for those people that celebrate Easter, you know, getting ready, doing your Easter eggs and stuff like that, we'll be back next week, which is going to be, what's today? Today is the, so it'll be back the 20th, and then everybody has Easter, if you will. So you'll be doing your Easter eggs maybe while you're listening to our radio show. So anyway, we'll see you next time on Building Fortunes Radio. Check out Scott's website. His websites are stoptheamwaytoolscam.wordpress.com. That's stoptheamwaytoolscam.wordpress.com and allmlmfacts.org, allmlmfacts.org. Thanks, Scott, for being here, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Peter. Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Building Fortunes Radio on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Mingle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segments. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.